The following is an encore episode of Hour 1 of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy.
To London. Yes, it's London calling you this Monday morning. Monday morning. Don't you just love Monday mornings? Well, look, you've made it this far, okay? 8 a.m. Central Time, Monday morning. You've made it. We've made it this far. So let's give ourselves a pat on the back. Welcome to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on the Archangel Radio Network, blasting out on 1410 AM, 94.5 FM, and on all those good streaming devices across the globe. And of course, it's available on the Archangel Radio mobile app, which you can download anytime you like. We even had somebody who was on holiday last week. He was on holiday from San Francisco. Dave, if you're listening, you called in and you said you would download the app and listen in San Francisco when you got home. So if you are enjoying Archangel Radio in the sunny Californian state, then welcome, welcome, welcome. Now, we've got a wonderful show lined up for you today. Our main guest is a very interesting author from the next door state of Louisiana. He's based in New Orleans, and he's written an absolutely fascinating book about the brown pelican. Yes, I know. I thought to myself, brown pelican? Stick around. You're going to enjoy that. That's coming up in the next segment. We've got Divine Mercy at the top of the hour, of course, and you can be part of that. You can call in on 888-928-0881, or you can text me on 251-928-2111. Only too happy to pray for you or your intentions. And if we have prayed for you or any of your intentions and you've got something to tell us, something to report, why not do that as well? Because you know what? The more people tell us about what's happening and the good things that come out of prayer, well, it encourages us all to pray just that little bit more. Story time today is about an anniversary which occurred on Friday. I was going to tell you the story on Friday, but events overtook us. And that is the story about how one film in the 1960s changed the course of cinema history, and not for the best. Now, to find out what that film is and who it was and when it was made and how it affected not just American cinema, but perhaps American society, you're going to have to tune in to the final sequence of this show. But before all that, we go where no other show dares to go. And just at the weekend, it was brought to my attention that something was rumbling, happening in Germany that needed to be talked about. Now, you know, we had the recent sad passing for us, of Benedict XVI. The great Pope went off to his eternal reward, and we prayed for him on this show. And it's us that's sad, not him. He had a good life, a good long life. Well, a traditional toy manufacturer in the picturesque Bavarian town of Coburg has produced two limited editions of its iconic teddy bears in honor of Pope Benedict XVI. That's right. The family-run Hermann Teddy Fabrik made only 265 of each edition because it says in a handout, Pope Benedict XVI is the 265th pope in the history since Peter. Well, that's true. So that's why there's 265 of these limited editions. Now, what are they? Well, there's a larger toy you can purchase at a mere $215. I know. The larger toy commemorates the pontiff and is dressed in the white papal cape, wears a zakuta on his head. That's the little hat that the Pope wears. And he sports a Lurex gold sash. $215 for that. Or you can get the smaller version, which has a popular growling voice. Yes, Herman, the gentleman who runs the company, published an audio recording of this iconic sound on the website, which you can go and have a look at, and I'll give you the details in a moment. But the smaller bear is stuffed with wood shavings and is supposed to be cuddlier. I have no hands-on evidence of this, but it's cuddlier. It's certainly cheaper. It's selling at $53. $53 for this little teddy bear. And this little teddy bear has a small scroll with the true story, inverted commas, about the childhood of Benedict XVI. Now, this true story is allegedly that the two-year-old Joseph Ratzinger, as he was then, was growing up in rural Bavaria, and he always wanted a teddy bear. And he saw in the local toy maker's shop window a beautiful little teddy bear, and he so much wanted that teddy bear. But the little Joseph was devastated when he saw that that toy had disappeared just a few days before Christmas, only for that toy to reappear under the Christmas tree a few days later. And it was a little gift from the Lord, he thought. That's the story. That's the true story. Who knows? But anyway, I'm delighted to say that we have the director of this firm, Martin Herrmann, on the line for us today from Germany. Martin Herrmann, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Hello, and best regards from Germany, from Bavaria, from the home of our passing Pope. And I hope I can tell you something more about our great two teddy bears.
Well, I mean, before we get to that, Martin, I mean, it's a wonderful tie-in. I mean, first of all, the question on my mind is, do people actually buy these teddy bears?
Oh, yes. They are collectible pieces, and there is a big run to both bears, because we are very famous for our personalities, for our personality bears, and we make teddy bears for all persons, like the Queen of England and German kings and people who are very famous, including Angela Merkel. And so this is one of our things. We are very famous worldwide for these things. And when a German man became Pope, it was an honor for us in 2005 to make a teddy bear for him. And then we followed the life of Pope Benedict with several designs. And even now, when he's passing away, we have to finish this line with a very special in memoriam Pope Emeritus teddy bear.
So, you know the teddy bear that you created in 2005, Martin. Did you present that to Pope Benedict? Has he seen it, or did he see
yes,
it?
Yes, he gets the bear. He gets a piece of this, and we also get a letter from the Vatican back, where he honors. Where he says, "Say thank you for the teddy bear which we sent him," and we were very proud that he really has seen the bear and that he loves the bear.
Wow, that's incredible. Well, tell me this. How did, I mean, you're a family-run firm. That's the interesting thing. I think it's you and your wife run this firm, Dr. Ursula.
Yes, yes.
I mean, how long has your family been in the business of making teddy bears?
Oh, yes, we are a family-driven company. We are now in the third generation. My grandfather founded the company over 100 years ago in the year 1920. And since this time, the company is run by our family, and my grandfather gave the company to my father, and my father, when he died, gave the company to my sister and me. And so we two, my sister and me, are running the company in this moment, in the third generation. So it's a really company-driven company, a family-driven company, and we are very proud to be in this line.
And as you say, papal bears are just one line you're developing, isn't that right?
Pardon?
Papal bears, Pope's bears, they're just one of a whole range of teddy bears that you create for the market.
Yes, we are. The Pope line is one of our lines. We are very famous, very extremely famous worldwide for our personality teddy bears. For example, we are very also in the United States very famous our Angela Merkel bear for the Chancellor of Germany, mm-hmm. the former Chancellor of Germany, or we make the Queen of England. We have a whole line for the over the royals in England,
yes.
because our hometown Coburg is very very close to the Windsors. And so there's a strong connection between Coburg and London. And so
Absolutely.
We have a lot of personalities, and all are collectibles, all are limited editions. And we only make the highest quality materials you can buy in the market. They are all made in Germany. All our teddy bears are made in Germany, here at the same place where we phone now from my office. In the opposite of the street is the factory. And so we have a complete control over the quality of the production, so that each bear is a real perfect piece.
Just on that then, I mean, does that mean that you have, do you have a Donald Trump teddy bear, for example?
No, we had a Barack Obama teddy bear, and we have a Lincoln teddy bear, and we have a Theodore Roosevelt teddy bear, but we had no Trump teddy bear.
Not yet.
Not yet. Not yet.
Well, what is your biggest selling teddy bear?
Biggest selling teddy bears is hard to say because it depends on the limited edition. If you have a limited edition of 265 pieces, then it stopped in this thing after these quantities. But we have also made editions, also for America, of Bavarian style teddy bears, which had a limited edition of over 10,000 pieces, which were all produced and sold to the United States.
But it sounds, Martin, like the teddy bears you're producing are not really for children. They're collector's items, aren't they? There's probably is there a constituency out there of people who await your latest line, your latest teddy bear, because they just collect teddy bears?
Yes, we have collectors who have hundreds of teddy bears, and they are really specialized in collecting the teddy bears. And you have already noted the price of the teddy bears, and you see they are no children toys. They are really valuable, extremely valuable pieces. They are all made of mohair. They are stuffed with excelsior. They have the traditional growler voice. They are jointed. So we put in these, in our teddy bears, only very valuable things. They are pieces for the next generations to come. So sometimes we get teddy bears 50 years, and they are looking brand new. And so 50, 60, 80 years is nothing for our teddy bears. They are really teddy bears for generations.
But these are not the teddy bears then that you sort of tuck in at night with your little loved ones, and they sort of cuddle them, and they accidentally throw them in the bath, and they leave them behind on park benches. It's not really that type of teddy bear, is it?
I really understand what you mean now.
I suppose what I mean, Martin, is that when I was growing up, I had a teddy bear, but it was a sort of teddy bear that left behind places, was sewn together so many times by my mother because I was constantly carrying it around, right? And I was sleeping with it and running around with it. But these teddy bears are more sort of artistic artifacts that probably go in collectors.
In former times, when the bears which my grandfather has produced and also my father has produced, these teddy bears were made for children, and they are also made with mohair because this was the material in these times, and they are also stuffed with excelsior. But now we are in the new generation, the teddy bear collector normally starts with their own bears of their childhood, and then they bring the bear for restoration, and then they bought the second one, the third one, and so they try to bring a little collection to add more pieces, and they want not toy. They want some valuable pieces which we can decorate it, which they can show in their showcases in their homes. And there are collectors who have more than $200,000 invested in the teddy bears because they are also an investment piece.
Wow. Listen, you said that you did royal families. Does that mean you've got a Prince Harry and a Meghan Markle teddy bear?
We have a Prince Harry teddy bear, we have a Prince William teddy bear, we have a Queen teddy bear, we have also for the coronation will come Charles III teddy bear, and so the whole, also for the royals in England, because we are very, very close connected, because our town is Prince Albert and Queen Victoria, they are very close connected. We follow also the life of the royals in England with our teddy bears. And of course, we also had a Prince Harry teddy bear when he became 18. And yes.
So I also saw somewhere on your website that you have a Pope Francis teddy bear.
Yes. Also this, because when he became Pope, we also want to make a teddy bear for him to follow the idea. And but we only had one of this. We have only made one teddy bear for him, but for Pope Benedict, because it was a German pope, he got much more teddy bears when he visited Germany. We made a special teddy bear when he visited Australia. Our Australian customers pleased us to make a special teddy bear for them for the Australian visit of the Pope. So we go through the life, we follow his life in the teddy bear.
That is incredible. Listen, Martin, tell people, our audience is listening mainly in the United States. People can order your teddy bears from the United States, I'm sure, no problem. Yes. Tell me how they go about that. How can they find out more about you and order these wonderful Pope Benedict teddy bears?
Yes, very, very, very easy. We have a web shop, also in English. They go to teddy-fabrik.de. They go on our website, on the web shop. They put it in their shopping cart, PayPal or the credit card, and it needs about 5-6 weeks to produce the teddy bear. They get the information when the bear are shipped, and then they are go on the way, and we get daily orders from all over the world, from America to Australia. The whole world get the teddy bears from our delivery, and they all are produced here in Germany. They all are shipped here from Germany, and they really get an authentic piece from the history of Pope Benedict and the history of our company.
That's incredible. How quickly do you think these 265 teddy bears will sell out, the Pope Benedict ones, the latest line?
Yeah, in this moment we have an introductory price for the bear. There are a handful pieces left for this special price. I think end of the week they are gone.
End of the week?
I think end of the week.
Wow, that's incredible. That is absolutely amazing. Well, Martin, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you about the wonderful world of teddy bear making and still alive and kicking in Germany, I'm glad to hear. Well, I wish you well with it. Whenever your next line of teddy bears is out there, or especially ones that are papal, though I did notice you had a teddy bear of Martin Luther, which I was a little bit disappointed in, I have to say, Martin. But any papal teddy bears, we're all ears, okay?
Yeah, we have Martin Luther, and we go to all the ranges.
you're ecumenical when it comes to teddy bears. Yes. Martin, thank you so much for coming on the show this morning. Being such a good sport, and I wish you well with your Pope Benedict XVI teddy bears.
Yes, thank you that I was happy to be invited from you. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. So if you want to find out more about that line of teddy bears and get in there before they sell out on Friday, you need to go to teddy-fabrik, that's with a K, FABRIK.DE. And the website is in English, and you can order your papal Pope Benedict XVI teddy bear and have it delivered. I'm sure that I don't want to interrupt you guys, but I'm sure Mike and Reed at this moment in time are probably fighting over the computer as to who can get their teddy bear order in first.
Mm-hmm. We're on there. I'm a little bit ahead of him because he was getting the music ready.
Well, listen, Reed, don't be greedy, right? Just one teddy bear per person.
Okay? I can't get all 250 to myself and then...
No, is the answer.
I don't understand why they don't have a teddy bear of me yet. This is terrible. Horrible idea. Who even thought of this? I would make a wonderful teddy bear. Can you imagine me snuggled up to you all night? I'd be a great teddy bear.
Well, listen, Donald, I did my best. You know, I dropped you into the conversation, and you never know. I mean, it may be something that Martin hadn't thought of, that I think Donald Trump teddy bear would sell very well, actually. I don't know about you. I think it would sell really well.
I'll let my people call his people.
I'm not so sure about a Joe Biden teddy bear. I think that may not sell so well.
Unintelligible.
People may struggle to know the difference, but that's a whole different chat show. Now, listen, when we come back... we are going to be talking about pelicans. Now, the brown pelican in particular, and you might think, well, what's all this brown pelican? Well, the man we're speaking to is coming to us from New Orleans, Louisiana. And as you know, Louisiana on its state flag has the brown pelican. And that might give us a clue as to what it is we're about to talk about. So put your teddy bears down and pick up your pelicans. But above all, stay with the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I don't want to be a lion, cause lions ain't the kind you love enough.
What does it want to be? Your teddy bear.
Turley Frequency coming to you live this morning from a very sunny but a very cold London town, and it's great to have your company this Monday morning. Don't you just love Monday mornings? We all do. Anyway, enough about teddy bears. We're moving on to another member of the animal kingdom, and that is brown pelicans, because I have Ryan Fertel, a Louisiana-based writer and teacher. And he currently is a visiting professor of history at Tulane University, and he holds a PhD in history from that university, which also happens to have as a mascot the pelican, I noticed. Anyway, he teaches courses at the University of Mississippi and Loyola University in New Orleans, and he has taught, interestingly, yoga classes at two juvenile jails in the New Orleans area. Maybe we'll get on to that as well. Now, he does all this from, as I say, his New Orleans home, where he lives part-time in a 100-plus-year-old church called St. Martinville, Louisiana. It gets more interesting by the minute. Now, Ryan is a writer, and he has published a number of books on very diverse topics, actually. His first book was about imagining the Creole city, an intellectual and literary study of a circle of writers in 19th-century New Orleans. And he's written other books, including The Drive-By Trucker's Southern Rock Opera, about a road trip based on a recent classic album about road trips. He's also written about food in the Deep South, but his most recent book, published just last year, is Brown Pelican. And in that, he tells the story of humanity's complicated and often brutal relationship with the brown pelican over the past century or so. Brown Pelican combines history and first-person narrative to complicate, deconstruct, and then reassemble our vision of the brown pelican, the natural world, and possibly humanity itself. Ryan is on the line to me from New Orleans. Ryan, welcome to the Turley Frequency. Yeah, I think if you could unmute.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me. Yeah.
No.
And my name is, it's pronounced Ryan, I should say.
Sorry, forgive me. I didn't quite know. And forgive me. First thing I was going to ask you. So, Ryan, that's a lot easier. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Ryan, talk to me. First of all, when I looked at your book, and I had a quick read through it today, and I was thinking, the first thought that came to mind was, which is something which you must have been asked quite a lot in the last few months: why brown pelicans?
Yeah, so I during the pandemic, I became one of perhaps millions of Americans who joined the hobby that we call birding. Stuck inside, stuck in our you know, our neighborhoods or our towns. I bought bird feeders, I bought a new pair of binoculars, and I was able to explore a diversity of environments just within blocks of my home from where I live in New Orleans. The state bird of my home state of Louisiana is the brown pelican, and it basically came down to I was getting really interested in birds at the same time that LSU Press, or Louisiana State University Press, who had worked with before, had asked me to put together a book on any topic I wanted to that had a good Louisiana story. So it just kind of all fell into place.
Okay. So give us the, for anybody who hasn't read the book out there, who's listening to this, give us the basic premise about how you could construct and also deliver a book about a brown pelican.
Sure. So I'm a historian rather than, say, a scientist. And so what I tell is a human history of this species, and really focusing on humanity's relationship with the bird. So this, one way I start the narrative with the disappearance of the bird around mid-century, around 1940s, 1950s, the brown pelican's population along the coast of Louisiana plummeted. And that was because of pesticides has started to disrupt the food chain. And Louisiana, which once perhaps had upwards of 100,000 pairs of breeding pairs of pelicans, that's often how scientists kind of measure bird species populations, that number, that population number dropped to zero in the 1960s, meaning that the Pelican State, we proudly proclaim ourselves to be the Pelican State in Louisiana, the Pelican State had zero pelicans. And so I tell the story of the revival of the pelican. But there were other revivals. The pelican was almost hunted to near extinction in Florida a half century earlier, when its feathers, its plumes, were very popular in women's hats. And then we have more recent problems, the BP oil spill, as it's known, in 2010, decimated the pelican population once again. So what I'm looking at is kind of this ebb and flow of what has happened to the bird, how humanity has revived the bird in certain ways.
So in some ways, Ryan, what you're doing is, is this what you're doing, really? Because it sounds to me that this is a book as much about we humans and our interaction, and it's telling aspects of our own human history through our interactions with the brown pelican.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, the brown pelican is a, you know, going further back, it's a symbolic bird for a lot of cultures, a lot of communities. Your listeners might be aware that, you know, the brown pelican, or the pelican, I should say, just kind of a general generic pelican, after, say, the lamb and the dove, is one of the most popular Catholic symbols. And
that's
it's,
right.
It's difficult, certainly in Louisiana, where I live and have grown up, but I travel widely, and I walk into churches all over the world, and there's a pelican presented as a symbol of Christ. So I tell that story, too. And it's a really rich and interesting story that, you know, I think kind of allows us to think about the pelican today and our relationship with the brown pelican, certainly, in different and interesting ways.
You're listening to Ryan Fertel, who is the author of The Brown Pelican, and many other things, and a historian from Louisiana. You're absolutely right, Ryan. I mean, if you were ever to come to London and I were to take you to the main Catholic cathedral in London, Westminster Cathedral, there is a huge pelican dashing its breast to feed its prodigy. So, yes, absolutely. This image goes back. I think St. Augustine, if I'm right in thinking, played on that image as well. But is the pelican a bird which has sort of – there are different animals which sometimes enter into the human psyche collectively over centuries. Would you say that the pelican as a bird has done that? I mean, obviously there's the allusions, you know, from the ancient world about the feeding its own and stuff. But is it something which the modern world really kind of gets?
Absolutely. So when we look at the pelican, if you've seen, and there's 8 different pelican species around the globe. So no matter where you are, there's a good chance that you can go out and see a pelican. But when we look at a pelican, what we really are intrigued by is its beak, that massive beak, and that kind of like that like seine net or fisherman's net that almost hangs down. It's you know, it's a gullet type device that hangs down from that beak. That it uses to catch fish. Humanity has been intrigued by this and interested in this, and has created all types of histories and stories and myths surrounding that beak. And it plays into the Catholic symbol of the pelican, which is often called, when we see it in churches and cathedrals, it's called the volning pelican. And that volning pelican, it's piercing its breast, feeding its chicks with its lifeblood. And that goes back to when people started, studying birds. This would have been without binoculars. This would have been from afar. This would have not been with a whole lot of, say, scientific knowledge at the time. What they saw was perhaps, pelicans pelicans, I should say, like a lot of birds, in order to feed their young, their chicks, they disgorge or regurgitate food. And to do that, they beat their breast with their own beak. So this is where this story comes from. This is where this myth comes from. And it's beautifully portrayed on my state flag of Louisiana.
Yes, because I was familiar that this is a total myth, that pelicans don't actually sort of give their lives for their chicks, so to speak. But bringing it up to date, Ryan, one of the interesting things about your book was the way in which, and it's a well-worn tale, I'm afraid, a sad tale, which is that human interaction with whatever the animal world is, it tends to be negative. So, for example, the use of pesticides almost eradicated pelicans from your part of the United States. Is that correct?
It did. It was pesticides. DDT is the most notable one.
So help us out, Ryan. Why, just for anybody listening, how did DDTs come about? Why were they so popular? And why did they have that impact on the animal kingdom?
Right. So following World War II, several pesticides were promoted as insect bombs, first in the United States, where they were created and being manufactured, and then across the world. And these insect bombs, Rachel Carson calls this, she's a great environmentalist writer, she called it the beginning of man's war against nature. And these DDT engines, they work their way up the food chain. So we're talking from algae to fish to larger species, larger predators. And several species in North America, including the brown pelican, including the bald eagle, the great symbol of America, our national bird, were wiped out. They were decimated and were listed as birds under threat for extinction. They were endangered birds, and each bird, were both the bald eagle and the brown pelican and other fish-eating species like the there's plenty more, the osprey. Their numbers were revived in totally different ways. And the story that the brown pelican, the story of its revival in Louisiana is really interesting. And it came down to, do I have time to tell a story?
Well, we'll come to that in a minute, because I think what's important, what shocked me was that for quite a number of decades, probably because of this, the pesticides that were being used, the pelican, the brown pelican, became an endangered species, right?
Right. Yes. Yeah.
So that was from when to when? Just remind me.
So this would have been 1950s, and then it was taken all. It was put into the endangered species list in the late 1950s, and that lasted until 2010. So right when the BP oil spill happened, when it was taken off the endangered species list.
So just tell us, Ryan, to what extent the pelican was disappearing. I mean, were we down to the last breeding couple? I mean, what was the extent of this threat?
So you're right. So in Louisiana, in the pelican state, literally zero breeding pelican pairs. So that means a pelican might be, say, flying within Louisiana's territorial airspace and landing on its ground and fishing in its waters during this 50 or so year period, but no pelicans were breeding in the state of Louisiana. No pelicans born in the state of Louisiana during this time. Louisiana had the largest, and again today, because of some amazing efforts by scientists, the largest brown pelican population in the Americas. Florida's has another large brown pelican population, not hit as hard because they do not have the river valley system like we do, the Mississippi River Valley, that brought all of these pesticides into its coastal waters.
Just help me out, Ryan. Was there some government sanction against DDTs at some point that reversed this?
So eventually it was banned in 1972.
72. So that's when they stopped using. And was that because of the impact it was having on the animal and plant life everywhere?
Yes, both on the brown pelican and limitless other species in the animal kingdom.
And roughly, I mean, since then, it's kind of revived. So 2009, it came off the endangered species. Today, is it healthy in terms of its numbers?
The brown pelican is looking, its fortunes, its future is looking really great in Louisiana. There's the problem of its the barrier islands where it nests being overtaken by Gulf waters. Those islands are being slowly not overtaken, but not only overtaken by water, but being worn away by storms, by hurricanes. But the state and the federal government is really putting millions and millions of dollars into restoring these islands.
Okay, just hold it there, Ryan, because we're just going to go for a break. And if you could stay with us for the next segment, that would be great, because I'd like to explore this a bit, little bit more, because it's not just a story about brown pelicans. This is also a story about how man and woman interact with the animal kingdom, often to its detriment. So you're listening to Ryan Fertel on the brown pelican, and we'll be deep in conversation once more after these words. Stay with me here on Archangel Radio. Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. And my guest this morning is Ryan Fertel, who's written The Brown Pelican, which is a fascinating story of man's interaction with that beautiful bird and to that beautiful bird's detriment often. Ryan, you said at the start that you weren't a scientist and you were a historian. And that sort of struck me as interesting, because I would have thought that this is a book that people would have written who were, you know, into birds and science of birds and all of that, whereas you come at it from a historical point of view. Does that make it a different sort of way, not just a different read, but also a different way of writing it?
I think so. I mean, I did my best to read all of the scientific literature, all of the papers and everything that have been produced on the brown pelican over the past century. And I think what really interests me about that body of research is the questions, and I can look at that as kind of like a historical trajectory of questions or chronological, you know, series of questions that the scientific body has asked itself about this bird. What interests scientists about the brown pelican, say, a century ago, and what interests them today? I was able to, in doing the research, able to hang out with several scientists who work at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, which is my hometown. There's always a dedicated brown pelican graduate student doing research on staff there. And I was able to go out to the breeding colonies, to these barrier islands off the coast of Louisiana, and see what these grad students are doing. And what they're really interested in now is how the millions of dollars that the state and federal government have pumped into restoring these islands, how that affects the life of a bird. Is the bird, is the bird producing more or healthier chicks or more survive, you know, chicks with a higher survival rate, I should say. Well, very different questions now than scientists were asking a century ago.
Well, talk to me about that, Ryan. I mean, 50 years ago, DDT's taken off the menu. That's fine. But that doesn't, you know, birds are virtually disappeared, virtually extinct. So how does a state, how does a federal authorities, how does anybody go to move it from a point of extinction to the flourishing we have today? How does that process actually take place? What are the nuts and bolts?
It's a great story. It's a beautiful story. And it came down to a group of bird lovers, Audubon Society members, and scientists in Louisiana. They had a meeting, and they decided we have to do whatever we can to revive the brown pelican in the Pelican State. And it came down to two scientists were handpicked out of the crowd. Louisiana had no ornithologists or bird scientists on staff at the time in the 1960s. So they selected two alligator scientists. And this is the, you know, this is, I think, a humorous point in the narrative of the book and the brown pelican. The pelican is very different from the American alligator. But the American alligator was also becoming extinct. Or it was endangered in Louisiana at the time. Just an aside, alligators were almost hunted to extinction locally. They're used for their leather. And these two alligator scientists, they devised this plan. And the plan was to go to Florida and to basically birdnap with Florida's, you know, the state of Florida's okay, to birdnap some very young brown pelicans. They threw them in burlap sacks, hot-shotted them as fast as they could to a wildlife reserve in Louisiana, and fed these birds from chicks to teenage pelicans and then to adults that could fly and fish on their own. It took several years. There were it took hundreds of individual birds from Florida, and it took several years to get the process right, to find the right age to really let them fly free on their own, to find the perfect mix of food to give them. But it all came down to that kind of wild plan at the time. It's a plan that has been replicated with other bird species since, but was really first of its kind.
So does that mean, Ryan, that all the pelicans that we see flying around Louisiana or elsewhere in that part of the United States, they're all descended from those chicks that were birdnapped from Florida?
Yes, I would say yes. So I have not read. I would love to see a DNA study of but it does not exist. But the quick answer is yes, probably.
It sounds like something could make a really nice film, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a wonderful story, and it wasn't supposed to work, right? And because it did not work for several years, and then one year, the pelicans, they kept placing the brown pelican kind of teenagers, I call them, on certain islands, and the populations, they would never last another year. And then one year, the brown pelicans left one of these islands and kind of colonized, or, you know, found their own pelican breeding colony on their own island that they selected. And ever since then, we've had, a progressive growing pelican population in the state.
You've been up close and personal with pelicans, I assume, given your through the university and the scientific departments there. I mean, do you know the way different animals are reputed to have different kind of characteristics, shall we say? How would you describe in human terms? I know it's completely not the way to do it, but how would you describe a pelican? Are they friendly? Are they generally territorial? I mean, what's the sort of characteristics to the lay man and woman about a pelican, a brown pelican?
So as long as humans have been writing about the pelican, they have described the pelican because of its, you know, that giant sack under its feet, as a greedy bird, as a bird that eats too much, as a ravenous bird. The pelican just eats enough to survive, right? The pelican has become, I hate to say domesticated, but almost lives within, especially within coastal areas in the United States, Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, even Southern California. The pelican has almost reached this kind of almost semi-domesticated state where they become used to being hand-fed fish scraps from, say, docks, where people fish off of docks, off of shores. So we have a one-on-one, very friendly relationship with the bird. People love pelicans. The pelicans appear in lots of animated movies, always as a motherly bird, a comforting bird, a bird that carries its young in its pouch. The pelican does not do this, almost like, say, a kangaroo. So we've definitely attached all these attributes to the pelican.
Now, I've had some comments sent to me while we've been on air, Ryan. I'll just read them out. There is a group of white pelicans near the Mobile Bay Beach in the winter time. I never saw pelicans when I was growing up. Now they seem to be everywhere. Is that true? I mean, have we gone from virtual extinction to being sort of omnipresent on the sort of coastal areas of the Gulf?
Certainly with the brown pelicans. So talking to my parents, talking to people who grew up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, even into the 90s, they always say, so many people have come up to me and say, I see so many brown pelicans now. I did not grow up with brown pelicans. The American white pelican that is being referred to here is a winter visitor to the Gulf Coast. And their numbers are also have been in flux because over the past a half century or more because of these pesticides. I certainly do see a lot of American white pelicans starting always. I time it around the new year. And they like to fish in Gulf waters. I see them in the Mississippi River and Lake Pontchartrain, which is just outside of New Orleans often. You can tell the difference between the brown pelican and the white pelican. The white pelican is basically twice the size of the brown pelican. And it's stark white, and it does not dive for fish. It it nets fish by floating on the water, where the brown pelican is this fantastic diving bird, one of the largest diving birds in the world.
You're listening to Ryan Fertel, who's the author of the recently published Brown Pelican. Now, Ryan, I don't know if you're familiar with the book H is for Hawk. Have you come across this book?
I love that book, and it was influential in getting me to write this book, but also to go out and be a birder.
Yes, I have to say it's a very famous book, won a lot of awards. It's a beautiful book. But the thing that I really liked about that book, and it crossed my mind when I was reading yours, was that book is, yes, it's about birds and about hawks, but it's really about the author. Yeah. And I wondered how much this book is really about you, not so much the brown pelican.
It is. It is. So you're getting at the heart of the book. I wrote this book during the pandemic, which was a period of great loss, I think, for a lot of us, if not all of us, across the globe. And that's the story I'm telling. I begin the book talking about a man, an artist named Walter Anderson, who was from New Orleans, but really built his career and is associated with the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. And through his eyes and through his diaries, I really look at he loved birds, he loved animals, and this is what he painted. But he saw the brown pelican disappear, and I really retell that story through his eyes. And was definitely influenced by all the loss, I think, in around me and in the world, in telling the story of this bird.
So it's as much a story about the bird as about Ryan Fertel.
Yes.
But it's also, I mean, as with H is for Hawk, which I know is a dual biography in a sense, but it's also looking at the impact of the birds on human beings, and it gives us insight into the human condition. I have to say, reading your book, however, we don't come across very well, really, as human beings, do we? I mean, if we're not using them as decoration, we're destroying the whole food chain and the birds in the process. It's not a healthy tale, is it, really?
I'd say yes and no. It's a sad tale. The brown pelican did disappear from my state, but at the same time, because of a group of scientists that really endeavored to bring this bird back, due to a bunch of faith that this was the right thing to do, due to maybe a whole lot of luck, it became this really, certainly a positive, right, a human story, because we do have pelicans again in the state. But it's a story about appreciating this bird and appreciating what's the nature that surrounds us and doing whatever we can, small and big, to do what's best for nature.
I'm assuming, given your residence in Louisiana, the reaction to the book has been very positive. People are very grateful, no doubt, that you've brought such attention to the state bird.
It's been a fun book to read from, to get out there and meet people who have their own relationships with the brown pelican and other bird species.
Now, Ryan, you are at the moment in book promotion. I had a look at your website, and you're off doing book signings and book tours. Tell people where they can find out more about you, about your book, and also maybe where they can go and hear you talking about the book.
So my website is ryanfertel.com. My name is spelled R-I-E-N-F-E-R-T-E-L. And I'm doing an event I'm so happy to do this coming Saturday at the Walter Anderson Museum of Art in Ocean Springs. He is really the springboard for the telling of this book. He begins this book, the artist Walter Anderson. And I'm doing an event in Alabama down the road. And if you look at and as well as other events in my home state. So visiting my website, they're all listed with links and times and addresses and all that.
After the brown pelican, what do you think you'll tackle next?
Oh, I don't know. I'm really focusing on teaching. I couldn't teach in person for a couple of years during the pandemic. And I learned I really missed being in a classroom surrounded by students. So I'm focusing on teaching. I teach in class on the history of New Orleans, on the history of Carnival and Mardi Gras, which is really fun. I teach every fall at Tulane University. And teaching courses on contemporary culture and politics. I love being back in the classroom, and that's what I'm enjoying now. But I'm always thinking about other book ideas.
Yes, and looking at your bibliography so far, it's a very, very eclectic mix of all sorts. So I just wondered what you would turn to next. Well, Ryan, it's been an absolute pleasure having you in talking about the brown pelican. And maybe you'll come back one day and talk to us about the great city of New Orleans and its wonderful history, especially its literary history, which is of great interest. And maybe as well Mardi Gras, because as you know, and as I've been absolutely drilled, the first Mardi Gras is really in Mobile, and that New Orleans somehow stole the idea. That's what I've been told.
It is true. It is true. much to the dismay of New Orleanians. Yes.
Much to the dismay. Well, Ryan, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us this morning. And I wish you all the very best with the brown pelican.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Ryan Fertel, and his book, Brown Pelican, can be found at all the usual places. It's a very, very interesting reading, beautifully illustrated, I should have said. It's got some beautiful pictures of brown pelicans with human beings. We can be friends with the animal kingdom. And I think Ryan's right. You know, it's a story which starts out nicely and then drifts, but we end up in a good place. And we're going to end up in a good place when we come back with the Divine Mercy right after these words. Trying to wash your face.
Trying to wash your face.